Belgium might be a tiny country, but we have a big Java community. Welcome in this Proud of Belgium podcast.
Welcome to the FooJ podcast, all your news about OpenJDK.
I live in Belgium and I'm proud of what's happening within the Java community here. As I was doing interviews at DevOx in October, I met several of these people and we talked about their projects, how you can get involved in OpenJDK and maybe even start a company out of it. In this podcast, I have for you Stefan Janssen about DevOx, Vox Days and DevOx for Kids, Ronald de Huizer about JobRunner, Geoffrey de Smet about Timefold, Johan Vos about OpenJFX and OpenJDK Mobile, and last but not least, Wim de Blauwe about his books. Let's start with Stefan Janssen, the founder of the DevOx conference, which started in Belgium already many years ago.
Yes, 21st edition. Over 23 years. We had to skip 2 years because of COVID. But yeah, it's just crazy. I mean, 20th edition. And because of COVID, it was clear for me, you know, I'll just love doing this and I'll probably continue doing this until I drop dead on stage. That would be the nicest way to go. It's like, just drop dead, that's it, finished, game over.
Maybe even on a live stream.
Yeah, exactly.
You're here in the podcast because this is an edition about Belgium. DevOx is a very important brand or an event within the Java community, correct?
Well, I think so, yeah. I mean, it all started with the Belgium Java user group, which now luckily Tom Coles is taking over, which I'm really happy about. Thank you, Tom. But yeah, it started like that with the team. We did like every month we did like meetups, and then we wanted to do a one-day event, and we had like 500 people attend. And then we were like, oh, we should do a bigger event like every year, which Java Polis started in 2001. And that has grown up to now 3,500 people, 5 days. And even more, there were other Java user group leaders saying like, wow, DevOx, that looks really like, I would love to do that in my own city. So we have now DevOx France, which is actually the biggest one. Congrats, Antonio. They have 4,500 attendees, but it's more a French event. But we have like in Greece, in Poland, in the UK. We used to have one in Ukraine, and I'm sure I'm missing one. But yeah, it's all over the place. I think we welcome about 20,000 developers every year over the different DevOxes and Vox Days, because we also have Vox Days events, which are the smaller events.
Yeah, so how did this happen? So you have the DevOx conferences, multi-day events, and Vox Days, what is the idea? They're smaller?
Yeah, so what happens is that people come to this DevOx event and they go, wow, I love it. I want to do this as well. And then they go like, but have you ever organized with your user group an event? And they said, no. Well, maybe start first with a smaller Java user group, see if there's a community. And then you can, if you want to, you can do a Vox Days. And so Vox is the anagram of DevOx, which allows you to actually, it's like an incubator. It's an incubator to see if there's a bigger enough community. You can use all the tooling that we have, the brand you can use. It's a franchise model. And once they reach 1,000 people, and it's multiple days, they can rebrand it to a DevOx. So for example, Greece, it started at Vox Days Athens, and they've reached 1,000 people, and now it's DevOx Greece.
We have a special in Belgium, we have the combination.
Yeah, true. Well, it was RCA who really wanted to do a Vox Days in Brussels. And I said, as long as you stay 6 months away from Belgium so we don't compete with each other, you can have also a Vox Days. Because normally DevOx is exclusivity on country and a Vox Days is exclusivity on a city. So that's how it works, basically.
So we as a Belgian Java community have the luck that you have two events we can join per year.
Yeah, you do. And the other thing we started was like DevOx for Kids, which is also a beautiful, you know, franchise, so to speak. It's a non-profit. I think we have a non-profit in Africa, in Europe, in North America. And that's already 10 years that's been going on. And that's Daniel De Luca, who does an amazing job. And we get support like from banks from ING, and hopefully Belfius might join us as well. But they really support it because they even use these open source workshops for children for their own employees' children. So it's a really nice way to get this STEM movement where they actually are starting to play with robots and code, etc.
We have here in the background the conference space with a lot of sponsors. It's quiet now because Venkat is talking and other very popular speakers. How important are these sponsors for an event like this?
It is really important. I mean, thanks to all these sponsors, we can really keep the entrance fee as low as possible. So without them, it would be much more expensive because it would not even be break even. So having these sponsors from a financial point of view, really important to have the entrance tickets low, but also it's the opportunity for them to show what products, what services they bring. And it's always interesting to know, you know, the new toolings, et cetera. So it is the commercial aspect of it, but it is like with IntelliJ, for example, you know, you can talk to the engineers, you can talk to the Google or Oracle engineers, they're here. Mm-hmm. So you can really discuss and ask questions. So you have that first line contact, which is very important.
Yeah, you mentioned some banks which are Belgian, but most of the people here with the boots are not Belgian.
No, it is really international. I mean, we're one of the biggest Java conferences, I would say, in the world now. So they really want to be here, and they come from all over the world. Same for the attendees. It is really an international event. Compared to DevOps France, which is more a national event, it's all in French. Here, it is really more international. Like the attendees, I think in general, we have it from 45 different countries, even from Japan and South Korea and things. So, yeah.
Yeah, someone asked me how much of the group is Belgian. You have any idea?
It's roughly, I think it's about 45% is like Benelux and 55% is like non-Benelux, roughly. But the problem is we're sell out in a few seconds, so I don't really do any analysis. It's like, hey, we're going to sell out. So you get a bit lazy on that level where you don't look like, where should we do marketing? We don't do marketing anymore because the tickets sell out in 2 seconds, literally 2 seconds.
You're doing better than Tomorrowland.
Looks like it, but it's a smaller scale, of course. But nevertheless, it's a very positive problem to have.
Yeah. I always say it's easier to get in DevOps as a speaker than as an attendee.
It sounds to look like that. It's just scary. But even from the speaker point of view, I think we had about 650 speakers submitting about 900 proposals, and we only select 200 speakers. Only, you know, it's still a big chunk. But the beauty is that we get all the engineers from the top companies submitting. So the competition is fierce, and the quality is like, I get goosebumps really, because like you have Venkat, you have you have Victoria, even Gregor Hope now. I mean, we get the best engineers talking about what they're passionate about. So that's really an honor to have that.
Okay. You mentioned a lot of names. Can we focus on a few Belgian contributors, Java programmers, companies that you're proud of?
Absolutely. Well, the things that come in mind is the people's tools that we're using. For example, OptaPlanner, which has now been rebranded to Timefold by Gregory. I mean, we're using that, of course, to do our scheduling of the conference. And I'm very proud. Like Geoffrey is really moving it to the next level. I mean, he's like starting to employ people. Even Tom Coles just joined, so he's doing an amazing job. So I'm looking forward to the public offering when they go public. But then they also have JobRunner, which we're also using. So what I try to do from Ronald is that I try to use also the tools that are driven by Belgians and get it included in the tooling that we use here in the DevOps CFP, for example, because you can have meetings with them face to face, you know, in Antwerp or in Ghent or in Bruges. So that's nice. But you also have quite a few Belgium speakers, which I really try to get that mixture of, be a bit chauvinistic as well. Let's try to get some new faces in, and if possible, from Belgium, so they get the honor to actually get on the stage. And it's often their ticket into the DevOps franchise where they can speak at other events. Like, for example, Loïc from Onyrix. I always mispronounce their name. But Loïc Magnet, he does a great job on talking about Angular. We've got the spec lead on HTTP3, Mark something. I'm really bad with names, but he's here. He's here as well. So we've got quite a few Belgians speaking, if the guy from Teamleaf, and so on. Sorry?
Ben,
exactly. So we do try, it is a focus point for sure to get some Belgians on stage. And for them, once they can say, hey, I spoke at DevOps Belgium, it really opens up doors at other conferences. So I'm glad to help.
So Stefan already mentioned the names of my next guests. Here is the next one, Ronald De Huyser, founder of JobRunner.
JobRunner is a scheduler which allows you to distribute any kind of task, either directly now or sometime in the future, and distribute those tasks over many servers.
You started it because you needed it for a project you were working on?
Yeah, I saw that often because this distributing of tasks needs to happen, but it often doesn't generate any business value for the end customer. So it's often hackety-hack done, and I thought in the end, yeah, let's solve this once and for all. Took 8 months off and went into my basement to develop it, and yeah, that's when I open-sourced ShopRunner.
So you open-sourced it, but how do you earn money? You have kids, you have a family, you have even people now working for you?
Yeah, so originally the idea was to create a pro version, so I could take out my wife for dinner once, because yeah, she allowed me to work for 8 months in my basement almost. But that started to grow, and now we have indeed four people in total, the fifth one onboarding hopefully soon, and 50 customers, awesome customers all over the world.
So I really like the idea that you can actually build something in your basement or your living room.
Yes.
Share it as an open source project and still, because that's the trick or the pain point of open source, how do you make money out of it?
Well, the pro version offers more features, and those features are some customers wants to pay for them instead of developing themselves. So, and then there is also, of course, if they have any problems, they can ask questions. They have more priority support than open source users.
You're a big fan of Java. Your tool is also built on Java. How do you look at the evolutions of what's now happening in Java?
I love it. I love that it's a release every 6 months now. I love it that it's going so fast. The virtual threads and the concurrency is really important also for us, because in Java 8, we need to work still on Java 8, I'm afraid, but as soon as you're on 21, we switch to virtual threads, of course. I like what's going on, and the community is the thing that amazed me the most, to be honest.
I was in your presentation yesterday, the workshop. You also mentioned that you evaluate the new features coming in the next Javas. Can you explain a bit about that?
Yeah. So Oracle reached out to ask whether to test new JDK releases so that they are sure that they don't break anything, and we are sure that we still work on the new JDK releases. And this allowed us to test virtual threads, for example, already back in 2021 when it was not even preview. And yeah, it's a really nice collaboration where we just say, hey, all our tests are still green on JDK 23, 24 soon. And we send them an email and they know, okay, this has been validated by other users than us, just to make sure that things keep on working.
You're the founder, you're the developer, you're the DevRel now. How important is being at a conference like this?
To be honest, I think for me, everything started at a conference. I was allowed to speak at Spring I.O. in Barcelona. And there, one of my first customers, Decathlon, had some developers over there. And by speaking at the conference and showing that you have some maturity, it really convinced some people and stakeholders to take the pro version. So the community building, the getting to know, these informal talks that we are having often, these are the ones where yeah, friendships are made and deals are closed.
About deals, so I call this podcast Proud of Belgium, but actually you have some sponsoring or some funding from the government to share the knowledge about ShopRunner at other countries?
Yeah. Yeah, so last year, indeed, we got some extra subsidies, it's called, indeed, and this is also something I really like of being a Belgian-based startup, subsidies to go promote ShopRunner in the US, in Spain, in Oslo. So they give you a travel budget to go speak, and also other budgets if you can show the value that it brings to the company.
You've taken this big jump of building something yourself and building a company out of it. Is it something you would advise to others? Try it if you really have a good idea?
Yes, but be prepared of what's coming because the things is happening that I never could dream of. It's been long hours, working long hours. You have customers calling on a Friday, Saturday night, sometimes stuff that you don't always have to deal with when you are just an employee. So yes, but be prepared of the consequences if you want to do this.
As we heard before, the schedule of DevOps is generated with Timefold. Geoffrey de Smet, the CTO of Timefold, explains what his tool can do.
Timefold Solver is an open source solver to solve planning problems. And we are now also releasing our platform, which is just a REST API where you send in a planning problem and we send you back the solution.
So it helps me to schedule classrooms and classes and teachers?
Yeah, you can solve any kind of planning problem with it. For example, field service routing, where you want to assign a number of technicians who drive on the road to figure out which technician does which job and in which order. Or you can do shift scheduling with it, for example, to assign nurses or doctors or security guards to shifts. So when a nurse or somebody else says, when an employee says, I want to be free on Friday afternoon, that we actually try to accommodate for that. Mm-hmm. And we also do machine job scheduling and school timetabling and conference scheduling, for example, for DevOps.
What is the problem with schedule? Isn't it just assigning teachers to classrooms?
It might seem that simple, right? But these problems are what they call NP-hard, which basically means that if you say, I take one of these tasks and assign it to a person, right, that you don't know which task to assign first. Now, you could say, okay, I'm just going to take the tasks and assign them greedily. Just take the top task, assign it to a person, take the next task, assign it to the person. But you've probably started out with the wrong task. Well, I can pretty much guarantee you that the chance you start out with the right chance is like one. It's easier to win the lottery, right? So the amount of combinations you can actually solve these planning problems with, like the amount of different ways you can assign, let's say, 100 shifts to 20 people or 100 visits to 20 technicians or whatever the case, right? It's not just billions, it's not just trillions, it's actually 10 to the power 80 and stuff like that. So what we do is we try to find find a near optimal solution or the optimal solution within reasonable time by throwing AI algorithms at it.
AI, the buzzword?
Yes.
Is it the only solution you can have for this kind of complex problems?
So it is AI, but it's not machine learning and it's not LLMs, right? So it's not Gen AI. We call it planning AI. So basically, there's a number of algorithms out there who can do this for you. They've been around for quite some time. We've just improved them and make them easier to use. Some of these algorithms are, for example, meta-heuristics, which we use, or construction heuristics, which we also use. Others are mixed interior linear programming and things like that, right? So it is AI. All right. We deliver better results than a human can in a fraction of the time, and not just a little bit better, actually significantly better. For example, in field service routing, we reduce the travel time by 25%, to give you an example, over human planning. So it's the return on investment is really big, not millions, but hundreds of millions in some cases. But the algorithms behind it are here for quite a long time, but we're always very difficult to use, and we've just simplified that.
So there's a lot of mathematics and complex.
Yes, but not if you use us. So that's under the hood. So we do a lot of crazy stuff down there, probabilism and stuff like that. It's really a lot of fun when you go under the hood. But when you use it, you just send in, with the solver, you define your model, right? With the open source solver, you define your model. You have it and you just say, okay, solve this for me. With our REST APIs, which are not open source for the record, you just send this. You send us the vehicles, the visits, and we send you back, okay, this visit to that vehicle. Right.
This was an open source project, correct?
Yes. Yeah, OptoPlanner. So I started it 18 years ago in my spare time for 7 years, then 9 years for Red Hat. And so when OptoPlanner had no longer a future, it's end of life now, we continued it with Timefold as a company. And so the solver is still fully open source. Mostly open source. We have one or two features that is part of the enterprise offering we give. But we're actually now starting with the models which I talked about earlier. Right.
You're in this podcast because it's called Proud of Belgium. So this is a Belgian product. It's now also a Belgian company. You have some funding, correct?
Yes, so we've had two rounds of funding. So from the Smartphone, which is a Belgium VC, which invested a year and a half ago in with us, and also now from Lakestar, which is a German, even bigger VC, who we're continuing the project like this, of course, right?
I just talked with JobRunner. Same thing, so going from something open source, something you wanted to create for yourself because you had a problem to solve. Is it a good idea for, in your mind, to start a company for someone who has this? Is it this crazy ride?
Starting a company in general takes a piece of your soul. You have to, I cannot stress that enough, right? Is it worth it? Well, it's what my life's work, so I would do it again, right? There's no way I could let... So 2 years ago, when I saw that my open source project, Optoplanner, that's used all across the world, would die, I had no other option to do this. I would make the same decision again. Have I gotten a bunch of gray hairs behind it because of this? Might not be as obvious as it right now, but yes, I've lost hair on this. No doubt about it. It keeps you up at night. Is it worth it? Yes. Is it an adventure? Definitely. So can definitely recommend it. There's a lot of things to learn. Just the technology alone is not a lot enough. That's when you build the technology, you have validation of your product. When you achieving product market fit, figuring out the go-to market, that's just a few words, but it took me, I'm 2 years in and I'm still learning what go-to market is today. And so do find somebody who knows those kind of things when you start a project, a good co-founder. I'm very lucky to found a good co-founder on this, a good team. I'm extremely lucky with my entire team. And figure these things out. Mm. And then it's absolutely worth it. But it's not easy. And you have to have a lot of patience, yes. And
how important is a conference like this?
For me personally, a lot. For me, the only way I learn is to by going to this conference. For me, this is the yearly training. This is my education. This is where I learn what the new technologies are there, how we should integrate. It's also the place to network, of course, to figure out, okay, how does our technology work well with others and where can we fit into each other? So definitely, DevOx is great. I would not miss it any year, right?
You say go to market and marketing, so you're just starting as a company. You're not here as in the exhibition hall.
Yep.
Yet, or would that be a necessary next step for you?
Definitely, we want to be here someday, right? That's in the booth. So budget-wise, it's making choices, right? So last year we presented here. This year we didn't have time to submit in time, but we would love to present again. But that's relatively cheap. You just have to have a good talk that's useful for people, right? And get accepted, which is hard, by the way, in DevOx, especially in DevOx. And the booth costs money. And so, of course, that's a matter of making budget for that kind of things, right? Yeah.
Johan Vos is co-founder of the Belgian-based company Gluon. He is the lead of the OpenJDK mobile project and the co-lead of the OpenJFX project. I first wanted to learn from him what his role is in that OpenJFX project.
JavaFX development happens in an open repository and in an open collaboration effort, which is a sub-project of the OpenJDK project. So in that OpenJFX project, we have two team leads, which is Kevin Rushford from Oracle and myself. And we have we contain the vision on the overall architecture. We decide what can go in and what should wait a bit in the repository. So we are the community stewards of the project. We provide the overall guidelines, but in the end it is the community contributors who are actually the ones who write the code who ultimately decide what will happen in JavaFX.
How did this happen? How did you, as a Belgian guy, end up in this Java community at some point?
Well, the thing about OpenJFX, so why I got there was probably mainly based because of the history that I have with Java on Linux. So when in 1995, when Java was announced and it was not available on Linux, we were going with a group of people, mainly university students, who ported Java to Linux as part of the Blackdown team. And I was one of the people involved there. And a few years later Sun took over the Java on Linux efforts, but since then I've been on close cooperation with the people leading the Java efforts. And when Oracle took over Sun and for silly non-technical reasons decided not to invest that much anymore in JavaVex at that moment. It has changed in the meantime. Some people inside the Java organization asked me to step up and call it the JavaVex efforts.
Which is a very nice illustration of how open the whole Java system is. So anyone who is interested can take a look into the sources of Java, JavaVex, find out how it works, and can become a contributor.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is one of the things that distinguishes Java from other languages, with where there's a dedicated leader. In the case of Java, although Oracle is contributing most of the efforts, there are other companies, and especially also other individuals, who have quite a big impact on what is happening with the language. So it is really an open development, where the quality bar is very high, so it's not that everyone can just say, hey, I want this pull request to be merged in the OpenJDK mainline. That's not the case, but everyone is treated equal, whether you come from Oracle, from Microsoft, or from a small company, or whether you're an individual. And that is something I really like in the about the Java community.
You mentioned also JavaVex Mobile. So Java has the promise of run everywhere. I guess for JavaVex, it's maybe even a bit more complicated because you all have these different frameworks to render visual content onto a screen. Is that one of the big challenges within JavaVex?
Well, yeah, but that is actually the easy part. So the JavaVex, how JavaVex is structured technically, is by means of abstraction between the Java APIs that the developers use, and then the underlying implementation to do the rendering. And because that rendering is, we have a number of rendering pipelines. One is based on, or actually the main one is based on OpenGL, and that is something that we ported very easily to iOS and Android. So all the code, all the JavaVex code works fine on iOS and Android. The main challenge, though, is that on iOS it is not allowed to dynamically compile code or run dynamically compiled code. So we need changes to the runtime. And that is why we have the OpenJDK mobile project, a sub-project of the OpenJDK, where I'm currently the project lead. And that is an interesting technical challenge, and we're making lots of progress there. It already works, but we need to make it faster, and especially we need to shrink the size of the libraries and the binaries.
Okay. Are you using RAL-VM to compile these mobile applications?
We experimented with a number of AOT compilers. So we used the RoboVM AOT compiler in the past, and then we used the GraalVM AOT compiler, and it works fine, but we need to make major improvements in order to tackle the size issue, the size of the binary. And we're looking mainly at Project Leiden and really small but dedicated steps in the JDK. And we want to align this as close as possible with the main OpenJDK efforts, because we want mobile to be a first-class citizen of Java. We don't want to have Java and then a mobile port of Java. I really want that mobile is one of the key supported platforms of Java, which was actually the goal from day one.
Yeah, Java was born on mobile systems, on set-top boxes. People tend to forget that.
Yes, and that's something that James Gosling, the creator of Java, mentioned a number of times, that Java started as a mobile, as a language for PDAs and whatever, but it really took off on the server side, because that is where lots of the money is. And but James called it often that the server side is just a distraction. So it's fine, it's nice, but it's not. It wasn't the primary goal of Java. And the good thing is, you see that in the virtual machine, you see that in the class libraries and so, and as a consequence, it's not impossible. It's not even technically extremely hard to port the or to run the Java runtime on mobile. I think the main difficulty is non-technical because Java has the image of a well-bloated enterprise software, cloud-native Java, and so. And if you then say, yeah, but it also runs on a mobile phone or on a Raspberry Pi, then people are a bit surprised. And of course, the business model there is also different, and that makes it harder than the technical challenges are.
I'm really looking forward to what this will bring to mobile, the whole evolution in Java. Another topic, how proud are you of the Belgian side of the Java community?
I think historically, Belgium already had a good place in the worldwide Java development. We have quite a number of Java champions in Belgium, and Java has been used a lot from the early days on. I do recall on a Java 1 in the late 90s or early 2000s that the Belgium EID system was mentioned in the Java 1 keynote when there were still 25,000 attendees, because at that moment everyone with a Belgium ID card had a Java chip, and that was one of the major achievements, and Sun Microsystems was extremely proud on it. So we always had quite some innovators in Belgium in the Java world.
My next and last guest in this podcast episode is Wim de Blauwe. He's an author and software developer who is well known in the Spring community.
I do lots of stuff with Spring. I have quite some open source libraries with Spring, one for error handling, and then I do a lot of stuff with Timeleaf and server-side rendering as well. I have two books on one. A beginner book on Timeleaf, and then one more advanced with HTMX and Timeleaf.
So I want to talk to you about the book, because there are not that many books about, for instance, a specific topic like Timeleaf. What was the goal of writing the book?
The main goal for me was to summarize my knowledge on all the Timeleaf projects I did. I went back to my old projects to remember like how did I do that, and then I gathered all that knowledge, and I was hoping it would be useful to some people, and it turned out it was, and it still is useful to a lot of people. So the book is going well, so that's nice.
And you wrote the second one, which is then focusing on HTMX.
Right. There's some drawbacks if you only use Timeleaf, because you always have to re-render the full page and things like that. And Timeleaf and HTMX came along, and I learned about it. And you can do amazing things with HTMX and Timeleaf together to build really engaging user interfaces without having to go to React or Angular or anything like that. So that's why I wrote the second book, with explaining people how they can really augment their Timeleaf applications with HTMX.
In this podcast, we're focusing on Belgian products and books and people, importantly within the Java community. We are a very small country. How did you get in contact with the people of Spring themselves, or how did they get in contact with you? How did this happen?
I think the most important thing is, don't be afraid. Just go on GitHub, open issues. Also, being on Twitter helps also a lot, X now. But there you can meet a lot of developers and just tweet about it. You can start small. And I also started with a blog. That also helps. And where you just put out stuff. I think the fastest way to get corrected is just put out wrong information on the internet, and then people will start to correct you. And then go from there. And then I got lucky. I got accepted to Spring I.O. and then I got to speak on DevOx. And yeah, it all kind of flowed together like that.
As a book author, you don't become rich from writing a book. That's what I say. What is the main goal of becoming an author? If someone has a topic they're specialized in, is it a good idea to put it into a book?
I think for me, I don't think I would ever been a speaker at DevOx or Spring I.O. if I didn't write the book. So of course, it's a bit of recognition from your peers, and it was really fun. But of course, you don't have to do it for the money. That's true. Okay.
So you have this book about Timeleaf in Spring, and you have those Spring libraries. You were mentioned in the talk by Josh Long, right?
What's really nice now is so Josh did spring tips on HTMX, and also Dan Vega is also doing some things with the HTMX on his videos. So it's really gaining traction currently. Josh even mentioned me to be a community hero. I think that's a bit over the top, but it was very nice to that other people are picking this up as well, because I think it's a good technology and certainly something to look into.
A community hero, is that not one of the nice things about the Java community? You can get involved if you join a GitHub project or a discussion mailing list, that you can become a contributor or someone who drives a bit the direction of what's happening?
Yeah, I think from what I've experienced, the community is extremely welcoming. So I heard from some colleagues that are like afraid to open GitHub issues if they have, but don't be afraid. I think most of us are really willing to improve our stuff or to discuss the stuff openly and welcoming. So my main thing is don't be afraid. Just open an account on GitHub and open an issue. Pull request, even if you're feeling very brave, not a problem at all.
This was only a small part of the Belgian Java community, of course. Next week I'll be at JFOL to record more interviews, so who knows who will be in the next FooJ podcast episodes. Thanks for listening or watching this episode, and thanks to my guests, of course. Keep an eye on FooJ for future articles and podcasts about development and everything related to the Java world. Thanks a lot.
Give me a Foo. Give me a J, give me the friends of OpenJDK.